Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, WFED.
Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio. Every week, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller interviews CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now, your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is Rob Klopp, the Social Security Administration's Chief Information Officer. Rob, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Jason.
This is a specific type of Ask the CIO because we're talking about one program that you guys have had some success with, and there's some news around. So let's just start with the basic concepts. Disability Case Processing System, what is it, and what was your big win just recently?
Disability Case Processing System, which we call DCPS, is the system that we use to determine whether claimants are qualified from a medical perspective for a benefit. It's not the determination of the amount of the benefit, which is complicated, handled by a different organization. It's just the process of reviewing evidence and determining whether a disability benefit is justified or not. It's sort of an interesting process because when it was originally set up, it was outsourced by the federal government to the states, or actually the states and a couple of the territories. So there's 54 disability determination services in the states and the territories, and they actually process these claims on behalf of the Social Security Administration. So DCPS is a software system to provide both case management and disability determination business processes.
The interesting thing about this is for years, this was either done through paper or done in a type of system that was not necessarily, it was disparate. All 54 were maybe, or not all, but many were separate. Is that correct? I mean, the goal of this program has been to standardize and really bring it all together.
Yeah, this is really, we've spent lots of time, Jason, talking about IT modernization. This is really a giant success story for IT modernization. What we did was take these 54 disparate systems. There's actually five, six different flavors of DCP case processing systems that are run in the DDSs today. A couple of homegrown ones, one that's been developed in-house at SSA, and two systems that are owned by a company called MicroPact. And these systems are all really old, green screen, I mean, really legacy systems in the true sense of the word. And what we've done in the last 14 months is rebuild that system from scratch. I mean, really started from scratch using extremely modern tools, a programming language called Node.js. We've deployed the resulting application using Amazon Web Services, and the project has been run using agile methodologies through and through. And in 14 months, we have built a system that has, the agency has had trouble figuring out how to get this system built for years and years. So we did it quickly, effectively, and most importantly, because it's agile, we've been doing it with the DDSs as our partners every step of the way. And so the end result has just been received, with just accolades.
And just to be clear, the DDSs are the states and territories that have been running their own systems for years, right?
That's correct.
What's interesting about this program in many ways is this has been something that you, when I've seen you testify during FATARA hearings and during other hearings, the members of Congress are very unhappy about the previous status of the disability case processing system. So the reason why this is such a big win is not so much that, hey, in 14 months we did something, but because it's been a history of challenging software development and in many ways maybe someone could call it failures. I want to get into the more specifics of what the system will do and how it worked. But first, just a little bit of background. Because you've struggled with this for so long, not you, Rob Klopp, but SSA, that's one of the reasons why this is such a significant milestone.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that an attempt was started to rewrite this from scratch in 2010, and the agency outsourced the development to a vendor, and it just didn't work out. We spent lots and lots of money. The vendor was always sort of one release away from victory, and it just never came. And this time through, we've accomplished more you know, for a fraction, really a small fraction of the spend of the previous attempt, and deployed a production system actually in December that is now processing cases, end-to-end real-life cases. It's in production.
Just to be clear, I mean, when you say a fraction, I know money, we don't want to necessarily focus all on the money, but I think you guys, I remember at Hearing, spent something like $250, $300 million, and you've done this in the last 14 months for roughly 10% of that, 5% of that, less, more?
The original spend was somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 million, and we've completed this 14-month project for a little over $30 million. So it is a giant success. By the way, it's also a fraction of what the original estimate was, not counting the fact that this thing blew up. And you know, I think that this is really important because you know, there's lots of talk about IT modernization in the federal government, and you know, I think the problem is that everybody thinks that IT modernization is going to become a series of $250 million projects that overrun and become $500 million projects. And I think that what we've proved here is, with a team of federal employees backed by contractors, using agile methods where we're in touch with our customers every step of the way, really getting an acceptance test from our customers every 2 weeks, that we're able to go develop extremely modern code that can be deployed in the cloud really effectively, very quickly, and not just effectively as far as delivering the business functionality, but cost effectively. So all of a sudden, these numbers that people throw around requiring tens of billions of dollars to modernize, you know, we think that maybe those numbers can be one-tenth as well.
That's a key piece here, is that IT modernization, people think, is going to cost so much, and you guys are proving that maybe it doesn't. So let's talk about that process. I got to start with the fact that you're going from a green screen setup. I mean, was it running COBOL? Was it one of your COBOL systems or one of your Fortran systems? And then you're going to this modern technology. So first of all, what was the old system based on roughly? And then using Node-J, what are people seeing today?
The old systems were written in COBOL. Again, as I said, you know, there was a significant portion of the DDSs ran a commercial product called MicroPact. And those were COBOL green screen, you know, systems as well. The green screen systems, you know, were, I mean, again, this is really a classic legacy IT modernization case. The green screens, you know, they have no help associated with them. You know, if you have to enter medical codes, you have to memorize them. The DDSs, the states basically told us that it took, when they hired new people, it took them 3 years, 3 years to become proficient, partly because they had to learn the process of doing disability determination, but partly because every step of that process was encoded in these green screens that required them to memorize, you know, volumes and volumes of data that they had to key stuff in again and again. There was just no real, the user interface was really old and weak. And the new system, which is built with a really modern user interface that is completely 508 compliant and all that sort of stuff, that this new user interface is so powerful that as a usability test, we brought some case processing staff in-house and put them in a room with us. Now, remember, these are folks that understand how to do cases. Put them in a room, fired up the computer, turned it on, and handed it to them and said, here, just see what you can do. No training, no tutorial, no help files, no nothing, just an intuitive user interface to some people that were subject matter experts. And an hour later, the four of them walked out and said, this is amazing. We know how to do this, and we don't need training. So that's, I think, the other thing that is, I mean, maybe this is really almost more important than the message around, gosh, we think that maybe the cost of modernizing IT systems is one-tenth what people think. But the other thing that nobody seems to talk about in this discussion about IT modernization is the end result are, you know, systems that are so much more usable and so much more effective that can determine determine these cases faster with a higher degree of accuracy and quality controls that above and beyond the cost savings to the government of just running a modern system, there's the gigantic cost savings of all of these people that use these systems, and now all of a sudden those people can be more effective, and that's just a giant multiplier on the whole thing. I mean, IT modernization is really important. It's time for the government to figure out how to make all of these federal employees more effective, and I think that these are the kinds of proof points that allow us to go do this.
We have to take a break. My guest is Rob Klopp, the Social Security Administration's Chief Information Officer. I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My guest is Rob Klopp, the Social Security Administration's Chief Information Officer. This is a special edition of Ask the CIO, where we are talking about how SSA turned around its Disability Case Processing System, or DCPS. Talk a little bit about the process. 14 months ago, how did you get started? Where did you decide to start first? And then talk about some of the steps you went through over the last 14 months.
It's actually been a really interesting ride there. You know, part of the problem was the states, the DDSs, had a pretty good idea about what they wanted in a perfect new system. You know, one of the concepts of agile software development is that it's agile. And so what you do is you start with a bunch of requirements or user stories in the agile sense of the word, and you just start kind of building those things out and presenting them to the users and having the users say, oh, well, I like that. Oh, could you change that? Oh, you know, now that I see this, I can see that that's not really the way I want it to go. Can you change direction? And as you move through the agile process, these user stories change and change and change in a really interesting way, because people start going, gosh, you know, I thought that it was more important for you to do these five user stories, but now I can see that the system is so effective that those things aren't, it's not that they go away, but they're not really as important. I'd like you to now change direction and go in a different direction. And so we go through this really interesting process where what we've done for the last 14 months is sort of execute on a series of what we call product increments that are about 3 months long. And what we find is in every product increment that the user stories change somewhat dramatically, that in any given product increment, you know, that might build out, you know, 1,000 user stories, we might eliminate 200 user stories that we thought we were going to do and add another 300 user stories as the users kind of adjust. But it's always guided by what the end users think is important, and so the results are just, you know, phenomenal. So I guess the first thing I would say about the process is, you know, we sort of struggled with the start. We, you know, trying to figure out what the minimum viable product was, and it was only once we got into the process that the concept of agile and the way this all works started to kind of sink into both the users who are guiding us and the developers who are writing the code. And about 6 months into this thing, it just all started to click. The second thing I would say, and I'll actually take the heat for this one myself, and that is that we completely underestimated the learning curve for all the new stuff. Node.js is a brand new programming language. We literally did not have a single programmer on the team that had written code in Node.js. And Amazon was new, and Agile was new, and all of the environment, the whole stack that you use to deploy the Node.js stuff, that was all new as well. The architecture of some of this code was different and new. And so the first 6 months, productivity of the development team was really impacted by the learning curve. And we just stuck with it and stuck with it and stuck with it. And after about 6 months, it started to pick up. And now we're at the point we are crunching code at 3 to 4 times the rate that we were 6 months ago. And the interesting thing about Node.js is once you learn it, it's an extremely effective programming language to code in. But more interesting is it's also an extremely high-performance, very cloud-based programming language. And so the usability of the application, just because of the raw performance, when you click things, things just instantly happen. All of that has just become, you know, it's all part of the beauty of building these things in a modern way. Kind of the last thing I'll say is sort of about the the development side of this whole thing is, you know, we built all of this stuff using test-driven development techniques, which meant that every time anybody wrote new code, they were required to check in unit tests that automatically tested that code. And we put software tools in place that monitored what percentage of the code was covered by these automatic tests. This is different than the previous thing where every time we submitted code, people would go off to a terminal and start pounding in things and try to build test cases and manually entering, and testing and trying to find flaws that way. What we were doing is doing this thing. Every time we checked code in, these tests ran automatically, and within an hour, the programmer would get feedback as to whether or not his code passed the test or her code passed the test or not. So this automatic test development started yielding really high productivity because people were getting instant feedback when their programs had bugs in them, and they were fixing the bugs in real time. As a result, when it came time to deploy, we had an extremely small number of open bugs, and those bugs were stomped out really, really fast. We had some manual testers still in place, but we found that the automatic test stuff was finding way more bugs than the manual testers were. The code just came out so rock solid that when we finally deployed into production, we probably kicked up, I don't know, 15 or 20 bugs, and every one of the bugs was stomped out in a day. Our whole testing world in the agency, people's eyes just went wide and went, we've never seen anything like this before. We've never seen so few bugs pop out of such a major application in its initial deployment. And we've never, ever seen software built in a way that when we discovered a bug, the next day it was gone. For, you know, our usual world of COBOL and blah, 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 is that, you know, when the testers find a bug, it can take weeks and weeks for that bug to get stomped out. So this whole modern development, agile, better programming language, structuring the code better, all of those things that, you know, you kind of hear these mythical stories about fantastic results, you know, we just lived it and found that, in fact, it's all pretty much true.
So a couple things, let me back up there. First of all, you know, when you start talking about everything was new, Node.js, Agile, Amazon, everything was new, was that a little, if you will, scary for you as a CIO? Because you're really pushing your staff and the contractors that you guys hired to do something that has a high risk, but as you've seen, I guess a high reward.
We'll just say that my chief architect and I had very heated, difficult battles over some of these decisions. I actually probably recommended a little bit more of a conservative approach. And you know, the other thing I'll say is that I think both the chief architect and I at the time, I mean, we really did sort of underestimate how long it would take for people to come up to speed on Node.js. But, you know, I think that it's not like there was technical risk in the Node.js stuff. I mean, there were lots of people who had built much more sophisticated applications than this. There was just schedule risk. And the problem with the schedule risk was you don't know what you don't know. So you don't know how hard the learning curve is going to be. And so we just made some guesses, and we guessed wrong. I mean, you know, we think we had a fantastic success and delivered this code in 14 months. And I will tell you that I think that if we took the learning curve out, that we would probably do the same thing in, you know, 9 months or 10 months. By the way, what that means is the next series of developments that come rolling out of this team, we think are going to be at the high velocity, not at the lower velocity. So, yeah, there was some risk. We had a difficult time trying to figure out how to manage the new technology versus the potential reward. And in the end, we bit the bullet and went with the new stuff. And however painful it was in the first 6 months, it looks like it's paid off.
Do you have recommendations for your fellow CIOs or people in similar situations who maybe want to go to the leading edge, bleeding edge, but maybe are a little hesitant? I mean, you guys seem to, we're going to jump in with both feet, and that's scary for a lot of people.
I think that there's some things that you just have to do. I think you just have to deploy in the cloud. If you're writing new code today, I think you just have to deploy in the cloud. And one of the things I think that people don't always understand is that You know, there's this sort of belief that the cloud is just a bunch of virtual servers that run on somebody else's hardware. And I think that that's really not what the cloud is. I think the cloud is a new computing paradigm that's just as significant as client-server was back in the day. And the new computing paradigm allows you to write code that runs in really, really small increments called microservices that can be sort of elastically deployed across the cloud and expanded and contracted as the workload expands and contracts. And this is really powerful, and it's what makes the cloud so cost-effective. In fact, there are people that will tell you that they redeployed into the cloud and didn't find any cost savings whatsoever. And I think that that's the case when you just take a software that was not built for the cloud and move it into the cloud. I think you don't get the kind of cost savings that people are always looking for. So I think the thing that you just have to do, because it's the future for sure, is that you have to do the things to deploy in the cloud. Now, whether you go and deploy in the cloud using a completely new programming language like Node.js, or whether you use something like Java that you might be more comfortable with, you know, I think that you can make those decisions this way and that way, right? But it's important that even if you code Java, that you recognize that you have to architect the code to run elastically in the cloud. And, you know, there's some fantastic public information around things like the 12-factor application manifesto that describe the kinds of things you have to do to build cloud-capable software. So I think the advice I would give people is understand that you have to deploy in the cloud, figure out what it means to do that, and then you can decide whether or not you want to use brand new, very cloudy programming languages like Node.js, or whether you want to use Java because you're more comfortable with that. I don't think picking Java is a bad choice.
We have to take a break. My guest is Rob Klopp, the Social Security Administration's Chief Information Officer. I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My guest is Rob Klopp, the Social Security Administration's Chief Information Officer. This is a special edition of Ask the CIO, where we are talking about how SSA turned around its Disability Case Processing System, or DCPS.
The other interesting thing that you brought up that I think I'd like to shed some light on is when you talk about user testing and the user stories and how they changed, how big was your user group? How often did you meet with them? I know that, you know, every 2 weeks you'd give them new functionality and ask them to comment, but give me a sense of how you put that group together to work with your developers.
Yeah, so that's also was an interesting story. So in a perfect agile world, the end users literally live with your development team. I mean, they're embedded. And even though you do these demos every 2 weeks, the purpose of the demos every 2 weeks is to give programmers a deadline every 2 weeks, because we all know that people will code to a deadline, or as you know as a journalist, that if it wasn't for deadlines, you might not ever get a story done. And you know, for us, the end users lived in the States, and so we didn't have direct access to them. So what we did was we built a team of subject matter experts that were business people, not technical people, to sort of be a proxy for the people that lived out in the States. And we brought a really small group of the state people in once a week or once every other week. And so our proxies were in constant communication with the real end users and were sort of trying their best to, and did a fantastic job of representing them. But insofar as that representation wasn't perfect, every 2 weeks we would bring the real end users in from the States for a day, and they would basically go through this stuff and make, you know, the kind of adjustments that you would expect the real life end users to make. And so, you know, Agile is an interesting thing insofar as it puts a much more significant demand on the business to contribute staff in a meaningful, ongoing manner. And in the case of DCPS, what we did was built these sort of proxies, and brought in the real life end users just as often as we could get them in. We actually called them the Do It team, and it was really this collaboration between the SSA folks and our customers, the states, that made this thing really successful.
Now, the third piece I want to touch upon just briefly is the automated testing. I've had interesting conversations, for instance, with the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service CIO, Mark Schwartz, about end-user testing, and he's spoken very, very positively and highly of the fact that as you put code in, you get results out, and you can make changes, and automation speeds things up. Did you borrow and look for from other agencies, whether USCIS or others, for their automated testing? Did you have to set this up yourself? Give me a sense of how that worked.
So let me talk about testing, and then if I forget, remind me, and I'll tell you what we did borrow directly from USCIS. You'll like that story too. So from a testing perspective, I don't think we did borrow. What we did was we basically created a standard that said to the developers that when you check in code, you have to check in tests to test the code. And there's automated tools that will actually detect the fact that you checked out your program, you wrote 100 lines of code, and you checked it back in, and you didn't check in any tests. So, that code is not considered ready because you have to check in tests with the code. And so we sort of used the continuous, what we call the modern development environment. We use this continuous integration environment for developers to sort of enforce this rule that says you have to check in tests with the code. And we use code profiling tools in order to actually run the tests and figure out what percentage of the code is covered by the automated tests. So this is unit test on the developer side. And I'm not sure actually what the numbers ended up with at the end, but I know at one point we were approaching 80% coverage of all of the code in the thing was covered by automatic tests that were developed by the programmers.
And let me jump in real quick, Rob, because when we talk about testing, we're talking about 508, we're talking about security, we're talking about all those things that normally somebody would have to do on their own, right?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. Again, I this is one where I have to go back and see whether we actually deployed this at DCPS, but I know that we have it deployed elsewhere in the agency. But because these tests are automated, we have the ability to actually plug right into the automated test suite that runs every time you check in code, tests to make sure that there's no cyber vulnerabilities built into the code and stuff like that. And so this automated testing thing becomes very, very comprehensive and very sophisticated and allows us to really make sure that the quality of the code in lots of dimensions comes out properly. The thing that I think people don't think about is, in the waterfall paradigm, what ends up happening is, let's say you're going to do, let's say you have a really modern view of waterfall, and so you're going to deploy every 3 months. You still run into this scenario where somebody writes code, they test it a little bit, they check it in, and it doesn't go through really deployment testing until 3 months later. And so 3 months later, all of a sudden a bug pops up and you got to scratch your head and go, okay, so what is it that I was doing back then when I wrote that code? So there's like this fantastic productivity benefit that comes from this automated testing, because you check your code in and an hour later you get a flag that says that code failed the test. And so you sit down and you go fix it right away. And so all of this, the productivity loss of trying to remember what were you doing and how does this fit to that and what was going on there, all of those kinds of things that normally go on when you start testing months and months after you've written the code, all of that just goes away. The second part of testing that's really, very cool and very important is, so I think I mentioned in the beginning that requirements in Agile are actually captured as user stories. And a user story it's not really a story at all, it's a sentence. So an example of a user story, it could be something as simple as, the application will be capable of opening a case. That's one user story. The application will be capable of closing a case. The application will be capable of transferring a case from one claim worker to another. That's three user stories. And there's some really interesting tools that can read these very simple one-sentence user stories and actually generate the framework for a functional test right from the natural language. And so we use tools like Cucumber and Gherkin to build functional tests on top of the unit tests. And these things, like I said, they just derive naturally from the user stories. They take a little bit of work to flesh out the tests. But what you end up with is a small number of people who are using these really sophisticated tools that use natural language to actually interpret the user stories and help you build the framework for a test. We just use these things in a really sophisticated way, and the code that comes out is just extremely high quality. You know, we keep hearing these stories about how guys like Netflix actually deploy code into production 5 times a day. And you know, most of the time people's heads just spin on their shoulders going, how could that possibly be, and have the code maintain quality? But you can start to sort of see from the story I'm telling, when you're enforcing automated testing at the unit test level and coupling that with very sophisticated functional testing that come from these other kind of tools, that it becomes really possible to very, very quickly and very effectively create extremely high-quality code that just doesn't have bugs in it.
You mentioned the borrowing from USCIS. Tell me that story as well.
One of the interesting things that we had problems with in the first attempt at this DCPS thing, the one that cost a bunch of money and didn't go so well, was, you know, we just felt like we had, sort of contractors that were, we'll just say that they weren't focused always on building really good stuff for us. And the USCIS guys had this really interesting model where they sort of played contractors off against each other. And so what we actually did was adjusted the way we acquire contracting services. And in a project, instead of having the entire project with one contractor, what we did was we built a series of sprint teams where each sprint team was staffed by one contractor. And the sprint teams, you know, were assigned a certain number of user stories, and we kind of kept track on who was good and who was bad. And it was really, really clear to us, you know, at a really early stage of the program, which vendors were providing teams that were doing really, really well, and which vendors were providing teams that weren't doing really, really well. And we were able to go back to the vendors that weren't doing so well and say, hey, look, your guys really aren't keeping up, and that would change their behavior, and they would go out and try to get more capable people to staff the team. And we were able to go to the vendors that were providing really good work and say, hey, you know, we're going to add another team, and we'd like to reward you by adding another team and letting you staff it. And so we created this sort of interesting competition between the vendors that was turned out to be really, really productive. I think we just got really – the vendors really responded well to it, and we got just fantastic people out of them. The last part of the story, I think, is that in the beginning it was a little bit difficult because in the old world, vendor world, you know, there was this, you know, finger-pointing thing that went on. And so anytime there was a problem, that one vendor always pointed at the other vendor and said, no, that's their problem. And that other person pointed back and said, no, it's their problem. We had a little bit of that in the beginning as the teams felt that the competition between them was really, you know, sort of brutal, and it became bloodthirsty. But after a couple of months of sort of pounding on them and saying, look, there is a little bit of competition between you guys, but really in the end, all of you are either going to succeed and fail together. Then what happened was the competition really kind of disappeared between the actual members of the team, and they became highly collaborative, and they'd all go to lunch together, and I mean, it was really fantastic. And it was really just sort of at the executive level that we went back and said, you know, look, your guys just aren't really doing as well as some of the other guys, and found that it improved the quality of the people that the vendors were providing us. In the end, you know, you get good code from good coders, right? And this technique that we sort of borrowed separate from USCIS and morphed a little bit was really effective.
We have to take a break. My guest is Rob Klopp, the Social Security Administration's Chief Information Officer. I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My guest is Rob Klopp, the Social Security Administration's Chief Information Officer. This is a special edition of Ask the CIO, where we are talking about how SSA turned around its Disability Case Processing System, or DCPS. We've talked a lot about how the process worked, the types of technology you used, and the risks you faced. In the end, what is the user doing now? How many users are using the DCPS first release? And where do you see the future of this going? So let's start with, how big of a difference is it today? What do users see today that they, you know, the green screens are gone, but what else?
So I think it's too early to tell. You know, we have deployed, there are 54 DDSs. We have deployed to three. We have 8 more that are signed up to be deployed in the next tranche, and we're starting to figure out the scheduling about how to bring those folks on board. This thing has been so successful that they're now sort of they've kind of gone from being careful about becoming an early adopter into, you know, starting to really, you know, fight to be the next guys on board. So that's been really positive. And we're about ready to do a series of demonstrations to all of the DDSs of the actual production deployment. And we believe that there'll be another round of folks who are going to want to go get in the queue. It's sort of an interesting thing that you know, we treat these DDSs as if they're our customers, which means that we're not forcing them to go to this new thing. We're basically asking them to come on board when they're ready. And we already have 20% of the DDSs signed up. And we believe that in this next round, we might get another 20%. And so, you know, without having to use the stick at all, we just have been dangling the carrot. And the carrot is an extremely effective, custom-built, bespoke-built by the end users result that they just love. I mean, it's not a COTS product that we had to modify to go tweak, to go push to suit them some. It is custom built stuff, which, if you can do custom built stuff cost effectively, is always the best way to go.
You said been deployed to 3 DDS estates, 8 more are in the next tranche. Well, how long do you expect those to take to get those next 8 up and running? Is it a year? Is it 6 months? Is it less?
Up and running happens, you know, in a matter of weeks. I think I told you earlier that the thing is so intuitive that people just pick it up and start using it. So we're at the point now with these first 3 that just went into production, I think, on the 16th of December. So it's not even been a month with the holidays and stuff in place. But they're now moving cases through this and working regularly. In the next release that will come out in March, we're now on a 3-month release cycle. In the next release that comes out in March, we will add new case types to the portfolio of cases that the product can handle. And we think that in the March timeframe, we will have 20% of the DDSs deployed, and the DDSs will be able to process about 30% of all of their case load in the tool. In the next release that will come out 3 months after that, there'll be a significant improvement in the coverage that the product will provide. So we think that we'll be well over 50% of all of the cases in a DDS, and we'll be approaching, you know, 30 or 40% of the DDSs deployed. And so, you know, this is a rolling rollout where not only are we rolling in more and more DDSs as we go, but every 3 months we're rolling in more and more functionality. And our intention is, and you know, I think we're well on track to this, so there's actually not much risk in the statement I'm about to make. Our intention is to deploy a system that can support all case types by December of 2017, so this year. And we expect that within a year of hitting that milestone, we will be in a position where the vast majority of the DDSs will be using the product to do all of their cases. In fact, what I would say is from that milestone in December, the constraint isn't really anything other than how many people do we want to throw at accelerating deployment. And so one of the things that we're having discussions about now is, do we want to actually ramp up a new staff of people to do deployment faster and get these people on board sooner, or do we want to roll it out over a couple of years slow? Right now, today, at our current staffing plan, I think that we will not be fully deployed for 2 years from now.
And Rob, finally, I know we're almost out of time, but and this has been a great conversation. You are a political appointee. You may be out of a job, so to speak, as of January 20th. What does that mean for this DCPS system? I'm sure you trust your deputies and other people that work in your office, but does the leadership, if you will, leaving, does that impact the program? Are you concerned about that, or how are you ensuring that it does not impact the program?
The team is just rock solid, so you know I don't worry about that at all. John Garrigus is now in the lead there, and he's just a fantastic, really remarkable in leading this. And Michelle Minton is his right hand person, and she's awesome as well. So I'm not worried about that. There's the technical risk is gone out of this. The schedule risk is down to the point where, if I tell you I think something's going to be done in December of next year, the technical risk probably isn't any worse than the possibility that it might be January instead of December. So, the risk is just all gone out of this at this stage of the game. The risk that's left is, there's just sort of some political risk, and maybe it's a maybe this is is worth another longer conversation, but there is some political risk, and it's it's a shame because the project that we're on is just so remarkably successful, but there's still some unhappiness left over from the big failure before, and not complete recognition of the success that we've had to date. And I think that what we need to do is make sure that folks understand the giant success of the DCPS-2 project, that they understand that the giant success of the DCPS-2 project really bodes well for IT modernization for the entire federal government, and that this really is a proof point that underlies the really strong message that folks like Tony Scott have been saying in his tenure as the federal CIO.
Very good. Rob Klopp, this was a fascinating discussion, fascinating project, and congratulations, obviously, on the first release, and hopefully you guys can keep it going. Rob Klopp is my guest today. He is the Social Security Administration's Chief Information Officer. Rob, thank you so much for your time, and congratulations. And I should also thank you. This may be the last time we talk before you leave government, so thank you for your service over the last, 2.5 or 3 years.
Thanks, Jason. It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, Ask the CIO, Thursday mornings at 10:30, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.